This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Mike Kenyre. Later this hour, we'll meet a local man who moved to L.A. to become a special effects artist and succeeded. He's worked on big projects like Stranger Things and the new Predator movie, among many others. But first, public radio listeners know our next guest well. Paula Poundstone can claim the distinction of being a guest on the NPR News quiz Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me more than anyone else in the show's 20-year history. She was originally scheduled to do this show live last Thursday, but we bumped her to carry the show Sundial from WLRN in Miami as they were providing live updates on the school shooting in Parkdale. But we went ahead and recorded this interview. Needless to say, it was a somber time, and that's where we began the conversation. This is Paula Poundstone, pre-taped here on Gulf Coast Live. So today's show was going to air on Thursday, February 15th, but because of what happened in Parkland, Florida, we've had to bump you 1 week into the future, so this will air next Thursday. So do you have any thoughts or reflections on what's unfolding today and what happened yesterday? I mean, what are your thoughts on the state of the world that we see it as?
Well, you know, in the past, when there's been something awful like this, you know, I have sometimes tweeted out, you know, dear Florida or dear Kentucky or dear Colorado or dear, California, you're in our thoughts. But, you know, it's woefully inadequate. These things, you know, that apparently being in our thoughts and prayers isn't working. And so I don't know about everybody else, but I'm saddened and I'm fed up. I just, you know, the idea that we haven't done anything more than what we've done, we don't need those kinds of guns. And I think there's many, many factors that go into the problem, of course. But you know what? We don't need those kinds of guns.
Do you think that, or, you know, what are your thoughts in general on people in media and people in entertainment and personalities trying to use their pulpit to make that message clear? Do you think that it has any effect or that it's worth doing?
Well, it hasn't so far, but of course it's worth doing. Yeah, I mean, I feel stymied by so many things politically right now. You know, just like not sure what to do. I feel like I'm watching like a giant mudslide in my country, and I feel I have, you know. I was saying to a friend the other day, I said, you know, I feel like we'll have to take to the streets, not annually, but like, you know, the Arab Spring. But when you think about the Arab Spring, I don't know that it may move them that far either.
Yeah. So for a person who does what you do, and that is make people laugh, this might be sort of a cliche question, but it's, you know, so fresh in our minds right now. How does a world like this, where news like this is so common, affect what it is you do?
Well, you know, it's been an interesting last couple of years in terms of that. I mean, I feel like the entire country is suffering from mental health problems and depression. And again, there's lots of factors that go into that. And so there's two things that happen. You know, one is that I go on stage and I have the absolute joy of saying jokes that I think are funny to a crowd that's come out to laugh for the night. Mm-hmm. And there is a healing quality to it. It's not a problem-solving quality.
Right.
It doesn't fix everything. But I know from my own, you know, personal struggles or, you know, struggles being a parent, for example, which is ironically one of the loneliest jobs in the world. You're just lost in the sea of self-doubt the whole time you're a parent. And there's something so much fun about going on stage and talking about those struggles in a comedic way and having other people respond, you know, that, A, you're not the only one. That's part of the fun of it, is realizing, oh, my gosh, this struggle that I'm having is not unique to me in any way.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is, nature gave us this great thing, which is a sense of humor and a dopamine release, you know, from laughter. And I don't know why we lucked out as a species. I don't know if any other species has that. I kind of think raccoons do, but I'm not certain.
You know, there's a Tom Robbins book. I don't remember. I don't know if you know Tom Robbins, but he wrote a book where one of the subplots was sort of the power of laughter was something that was unique to humans. friends, and it was sort of a theme throughout the book, and it was really interesting. It's often given me thought in those realms.
Oh, I'd love to read it. No, I used to work in a bookstore, so I know I certainly know the author's name, but unfortunately, I read so damn slow. PBS has this thing on the NewsHour that they just introduced recently, this book club thing that they're doing.
Uh-huh.
And they're having, you know, their watchers join in and read a book all together and then comment online, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, you know what? I would slow the group down.
Because you just can't keep up.
I cannot keep up. I read unbearably slowly.
Well, for context, what's an average novel take you to read?
Oh, geez. Well, you know, part of it has to do with the amount of time that I'm able to dedicate to it.
Sure.
But I would say, you know, an average novel, probably 6 months.
Oh, wow.
Like, I'm 58 years old right now, which means that based on how slow I read, I can actually make my reading list for the rest of my life right now. So I tend to read mostly classics or nonfiction.
You presumably read these in book form on paper, correct? I know you have an aversion to reading off devices.
I do. It's not an aversion. It's a scientifically proven, you retain information better, as it turns out, when you read from paper than you do when you read from a screen, and that's, you know. I mean, a friend of mine gave me like a Nook thing from Barnes & Noble so that I could, you know, download books onto it.
Right.
And there were a lot of virtues to that, not the least of which is, you know, my eyes are going, and so, you know, you could make the font bigger.
Right.
And I was up to like a word per page. When I read on that thing, I look like I'm treading water. But mostly I read books. I like the feeling of the book in my hand. It's part of our evolution. We've just been book people for so long.
So what kind of phone do you have? Do you have a smartphone or do you have
a flip phone?
You do? Okay, yeah. Well then, yeah. Bless you
and
for being
way,
true to your word.
People are going to return to flip phones, and here's why. Because slowly but surely, there's been people even that work within that industry that are finally coming out and saying, you know what, we designed these things to be addictive on purpose. And now they're finally sort of revealing, oh, yeah, we knew that wasn't good for you when we... It's a little bit like cigarette companies. And so now that information is coming out, and people are beginning to see how it's ruining their family life. It's ruining their connection to other people. And so, you know, and yet there is a convenient factor to being able to hold a phone in your pocket that you can call somebody up on. And I know people want to, you know, stay in touch with their kids during the day, blah, blah, blah. But, you know... A young kid should not have a smartphone. So the solution a good solution anyways, I think, is a flip phone. I lost mine, which is a terrible thing because they're not all that easy to replace, but I lost mine. It must have fallen out of my pocket when I was going through security in Chicago at one point at the airport. And a friend of mine called me on it, and someone from the Chicago airport TSA answered the phone. And my friend was like, this is Paula Poundstone's phone. And the person, it was just like they were going to get information in order to be able to contact me and let me know that my phone was missing. And so my friend goes, well, this is Paula Poundstone's phone. And the lady at United goes, she uses a flip phone? There was judgment. It was dripping with judgment.
We are doing a show later this month that I've been planning for a couple months now that's framed as when to cell phone for kids, when to smartphone.
Oh, yeah.
Like, where is that line?
Well, the answer is, you know, cell phone and smartphone are two different issues.
Sure.
But, in my opinion, and I've done a lot of research on it because my son suffered from terrible electronics addiction, and the truth is, we all do. I mean, his was debilitating, but it's impacted all of us badly. But the answer for kids is never. That's the true answer. You want to protect your kid's brain, then the answer is never.
Does that include iPads and laptops and things like that, or where's the line?
Well, you know, I think the phone is particularly damaging because it's right there. You know, to me, an iPad is a useless piece of junk. But the phone is right there, and people grab it reflexively. I swear, I am not making this story up. I talked the other day to a therapist that works with kids, and she has like some sort of empowerment group for teenage girls. This is a true story, I swear. And as she's telling me the story about her empowerment group for girls, she tells me that during a group, kids in the group were texting her to say, why aren't you busting so-and-so on whatever they're saying?
Hmm.
And this woman told me this with a straight face. I'm looking around the room like I must be being punked. So she was holding an empowerment group for girls where they, you know, talk, and kids and she were all on their phones. So someone's like sharing from their heart verbally, and they look up, or they try to look into the eyes of their group member, and they're all on their phones? That's crazy. And I said to the woman, I go, well, that's absurd. And she said, oh, well, you know, you try to meet them where they are.
Huh.
Okay, well, I found one of our problems.
Today on Gulf Coast Live, we're joined by stand-up comic, author, and all-around comedic media personality Paula Poundstone in advance of her show at the Barbara B. Mann Performing Arts Hall in Fort Myers on Friday, March 2nd. Okay, Paul, I want to pivot to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me Now, and I have a very important question.
I love pivoting to Wait, Wait, by the way.
Good. What is your favorite, you know, in your opinion, silly or dumb research study to hate?
Well, you know, I don't remember them all. Okay. All right. There was one where I actually stopped the show and wouldn't let Peter go on because I just felt he had gone too far with these studies, which was, I think it was like somewhere in Amsterdam or some European country or something where they had, at a university, they had done a study. No, it was University of Helsinki. That's where it was. They had done a study that showed that people voted for Trump because he was good-looking. And I just said, no, no, no. You can like him or not like him. You can think he's, you know, the only person that can pull us out of trouble or not. You can think, well, he's a rich guy and he's going to make the rest of us rich. You can support whatever policies he's put out. But there is no one on this planet that thinks he's attractive. That's just not possible. And when Peter said that study, I literally was like, every time he tried to talk again, I was like, no, you explain to me how they did that study. And he would try to talk again, and I'd go, no, you get University of Helsinki on the phone. It was fun. And then he did another one. He told another one time where he said cats were the only animals who didn't, who didn't forgive. And I said, that was a tough one, too. I'm like, you know what? First of all, how do you know when a rhinoceros has forgiven you? That's ridiculous. And I know my cats forgive me because, for one thing, I'm losing vision. I have glaucoma, and so I've lost some peripheral vision, which means when I walk with purpose through my house and a cat runs in front of me, they often go flying.
Right.
Not intentionally, of course, but occasionally I've literally just kicked one up into the air. And, you know, a few minutes later, they're sucking up to me.
How many cats do you have?
14.
How quickly can you name them?
Oh, I can name them. Let's see. Who do I have? I have Clue. I didn't say it was quick. Clue, Severus, Hardy, Harrison, Bell, let's see, Tonks, Brittle, Fez, named after Mrs. Fezziwig, ShamWow. Uh-oh, now I'm getting down to the nitty-gritty.
That's nine. That's nine.
Oh, jeez. Okay, this is really getting difficult. Theo, Wednesday. How many am I? 11?
That's 11.
Uh-oh, this is not good. Oh, someone's going to be so upset with me. All right, maybe that's as far as I can go for now. I panic. It's like when people do the limerick challenge
right.
on Wait, Wait.
Which, by the way, got a little bit more complicated a few years ago. There was some sort of, I don't know if it was when you guys brought on Bill Taylor or Bill whatever his name is, but it seemed like the limericks got harder all of a sudden. Is that something you remember feeling?
Oh, Bill doesn't write them.
Oh, well, I know, but it just seemed to happen around that time where all of a sudden the limericks got more convoluted.
I don't know, but you know, you listen for the rhyme. I mean, so often people say an answer that doesn't even rhyme, and
right.
The whole audience is like, what? But it's just the stress of having to answer into the phone on the radio in the moment. It really has nothing. I one time did Will Schwartz's show, and they dumbed the puzzles down so much for me to begin with that one of the questions was name all the continents that begin with the letter A, and do you know I couldn't do it? I missed Africa, I think. You know, I've been to Africa. I like Africa. I see it on the globe. But for some reason, just in the moment, I was panicky.
Oh, I understand.
I can't do names when I'm with, I like socially, I can't do names.
Right.
It's a horrible burden.
So, in an average episode of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, how much tape, well, it's digital, but how much extra is done? How much winds up on the cutting room floor? It seems like you guys probably have to do something to have enough worked out, but how does that work mechanically, do you know?
Well, sadly, I've been told that when I'm there, the live show is much longer.
Right.
I have a tendency to be unbridled, in fact, I remember years ago I was in a cab and in New York, and cab drivers often listen to the show because they drive around a lot and so they listen to the radio. Not always, but often. And so when the cab driver heard my voice, he said, oh, aren't you, on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me? I said, yes, I am. And he goes, oh, Bill Clinton was on this morning. And I hadn't been on the show, and I was so upset that they would have Bill Clinton without me. So I went to Peter, and I said, Peter, why would you have Bill Clinton on without me? And he said, Paula, if we had had you and Bill Clinton on at the same time, we would still be recording. So they're usually, they do cut stuff down. I think they have a software for editing. That just when it hears my voice, it cuts.
Do you ever listen to the show, like, you know, when you're out traveling around in the world and Saturday comes on and you're wherever you are, do you listen to the show or because you're on it, you don't listen to it?
I don't really listen. Occasionally it's on my ride home from the airport. No, there's something weird about listening to your yourself.
Oh yeah, no, I would imagine.
And then when I listen when I'm not on, and I have, but I've not like sat down and listened to a whole show. I don't think ever. First of all, because I'm still bitter that I don't win, and so why wallow in those emotions?
You know, Neil Conan, who used to host Talk of the Nation on NPR, once told me that I asked him that question, do you listen to Talk of the Nation when you're not hosting? And he said, no, because either they're going to do it worse than me, and that's going to make me upset, or they're going to do it better than me, and that's going to make me upset. And I thought that.
I hear that makes absolute sense to me. I don't listen to lots of comics either for a very similar reason. Also because in the world of comedy, you know, I'm sure musicians have this problem, and authors and playwrights, etc., or artists, which is, you have this feeling sometimes that the walls are closing in on you, and that, the landscape of things to talk about is diminishing. You know, so I want to know that anything I say came from me. And that I didn't inadvertently hear something somebody else said and sort of throw it into my mix.
Gotcha.
And so, that was one reason why I stopped listening to comics years ago. But also, Neil Conan's premise is correct, which is, you're either going to hear somebody that you're just like, ugh, not really very good, or you're going to hear somebody that thinks really incredible, and then you're like, oh, man, So, why can't I have a slice of that?
So now that they've started offering up any guest on the show's voice on your home voicemail or answering machine, which I guess answering machine isn't really pertinent anymore for the most part.
I still use an answering machine, by the way.
Well, that doesn't surprise me, I think. So has your voice wound up on someone's voicemail yet since that shift occurred?
It has. I've done, I do what Carl did, which is, you know, they build up several of them requests, and then you go in and just record them in a row. And we do what, you know, the person writes out what they want you to say. And I've modified things slightly when it's, for example, sometimes when somebody writes down what they want you to say, they're unaware that, you know, it's two words in a row that are very hard to say in a row. And so I've sometimes modified things or added things in, but I have recorded not a ton, but several, and it's been fun. By the way, Carl Castle's voice was never on his answering machine.
On his own?
Yeah, it's always his wife, and I think it's because he doesn't answer the questions correctly.
I got to interview him when he was retiring. They kind of sent him out for, you know, 10 minutes for a station, 10 minutes for a station.
Oh, right.
And
yeah.
I asked him if he could record a message for my answering machine, and he said, "No, Mike, they don't let me do that."
So, well, he loved doing that show. And he was great at it. There was something so funny, just inherently funny, about like Carl doing, you know, a Britney Spears impression.
Oh yeah, I know. I've been, as you can probably tell, I was a listener of Wait before I even started in radio here. So, it's been a part of my Saturday for a long time.
That's nice to hear. We're coming up on our 20th anniversary, and actually, you know, this guy who keeps the stats, just a fan. His name is Lynn Pham, and he posted something the other day saying that it was 17 years ago that day that I started on Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Wow. How did that come about for you?
Really in the most boring of ways. You know, they called me up and asked me. And at the time, I had never heard of it. I was a public radio listener, but I didn't listen at that time, I guess. They sent me an audio cassette tape so that I could understand what it was they were asking me to do. They sent me a tape of the show, and I put it on the island in my kitchen, which I always suspected would gather junk, and it did. And it was just sort of in the middle of some stuff, and I had a nanny at the time. We were standing in the kitchen, and he said, he saw it, and he goes, "Oh, what is it?" You know, he said, "I love that show." And I said, "Oh, I never heard of it." And he goes, "Oh, no, you got to do that." And so I did.
Huh. Well, we have him to thank, I guess.
He's my, you know, I figure in retrospect, I should have had him manage me.
Can you kind of flesh out the difference, if there is one, between meeting fans who know you almost exclusively from Wait, Don't Tell Me, and fans who know you from, you know, your other more network and mainstream media appearances? Is there a difference between, is there two camps there?
I don't know if there's two camps, really. I will say that they've meshed in a lovely way into a terrific live audience for me. I mean, Wait brought more people into the fold for me, which is great. But they seem to get on very well, which I like. There are people when I do, Paula Poundstone at a theater, where there are people that never have heard of Wait, Don't Tell Me. And then there are people who don't understand why I'm not answering questions about the week's news. I always feel like Jackie Gleason when I say this, but it is absolutely true, which is I have the best audiences in show business, and I know this for a fact because when I was years ago, when I used to work clubs, and there would be like an MC and a middle act and a headliner. When I would headline clubs, other guys would kill to work with me, and not because I'm such a stroll in the park to be around, but because they wanted to talk to my audiences. And so they, you know, I was always told that other people asked if they, you know, like, selecting the MC in the middle act was fun because people were clamoring to be in that position. And again, having nothing to do with them wanting to hear me or see me, but rather they just wanted to perform to these audiences that are so much fun. They're game. They're willing. You know, one of the things about the way that I work is I don't have an act exactly. I have lots of material, 38 years of material. But it sort of is just in a big blower in my head. There's no real, there's no script. And my favorite part of any show is just talking to the audience, doing the time-honored, where are you from, what do you do for a living? And in this way, little biographies emerge, and I use that from which to set my sails. And so on a good night, and I like to think some are, probably about a third of the show is unique to just that night, hasn't been said before and won't be said again. And what's great is, you know, the audience is sort of willing to go down that path. You know what I mean? They don't, you know, they don't need like a joke every couple seconds.
Right. Has that always been your approach, or at what point did that much improv enter your sets?
You know, it kind of, I think it was like necessity was the mother of invention. I just have no memory. I can't, I have a very, very hard time memorizing a set. The more I try to, the more I would try to sort of restrain myself and go down a, you know, even stuff that I had written, but the more I would try to do it, exactly as I had written it, the less joy there was in the show, both for the audience and for me. It would just have this sort of nervous, bound feeling. After struggling with that, really mostly as an open micer, at some point it dawned on me that the funniest part of any night was when I screwed up, when I didn't do what I thought I was going to do. And once I figured that out, I just embraced it, you know. And now I have the opposite feeling, which is that, you know, a night really isn't good if I don't go off the range.
Right. Do you have you ever had like writer's block? You know, have you ever had like improv block where suddenly it was like, oh no, maybe I won't know what to say?
Yeah, definitely. And fortunately, as I said, I mean, I have 38 years of material rattling around in my head. I always figure that somewhere in my brain, it must look like, you know, those games at like an arcade where you can stand in a glass booth and they blow paper money around you, whatever you can grab and keep.
Yeah.
Well, I figured that's what my brain looks like. And so there is stuff rattling around up there, jokes that I've done many, many times, stories that I like to tell, or, you know, topics that I like to talk on. So I always have those available, and I can sort of jettison to that when I get myself in a bind. But I gotta say, my manager tells people that I know who to talk to in the audience, like that I have some sort of sixth sense. That is such a load of crap. Not true at all. The truth is, anybody that you talk to, you get them talking for a couple of minutes, and they're just great.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting, and this is maybe a strange analogy, or maybe not, I don't know, but when I first started working in public radio, they said, oh, by the way, you're going to have to do this thing called Pledge Drive, where we go on the air and we ask for money. And at the time, it was like the most painful thing I could ever imagine doing. And somebody who I worked with who had done it for a long time was like, eventually you just get to the point where you just open your mouth and out it comes, and you don't even know what you're going to say. And I thought, that sounds impossible. Well, now, many years later, exactly what you just described is kind of how I feel when I go in there to do those pledge breaks. It's like, I've got no idea where I'm going, but I know it'll go somewhere because I've done it enough times now that it's all just kind of there. So I guess it's kind of like improv.
Well, it is kind of a muscle. But also when you think about it, you know, because people do ask me about that a lot. Like, you know, audience members ask me about that a lot. They'll go like, oh, you're so quick. You know, we all have conversations every day.
Yeah.
And nobody, we're not working off a script. You know, I guess you could call it improvisation, but I don't. So it's really actually a very practiced behavior. You just have to give yourself permission to do it in that setting. That's the difference. is that some people have this idea that when you're on stage, you absolutely should be somehow scripted. And once you give that up, then the part where somebody says something and you think of what to say back is really, it's developmental. But it is a muscle, and you do practice it. And see, you've had so many chances to practice your fun drive stuff. And by the way, I couldn't do a fun drive for all the money. I don't understand the thing where somebody's going to give money, but they're only going to give it if we get 100 people to give money. That makes no sense to me. You know, really, there's a donor somewhere that's saying to you, I'm going to give $50,000 to, you know, your public radio station because I think it's important. I think it's so important that people be informed. I appreciate some of the comedy shows, but mostly I really feel connected to my community by listening to this program. They're going to give you $50,000, but if you only get 99 people to give, I'm not going to do it. And that makes no sense. Who came up with that device?
I'll ask our membership people. We only have a couple minutes left. Real quick on that topic before we move on to something else quickly. Are you a member of your local public radio station, Paula?
I am.
Oh, okay, good. Just want to make sure.
There are years where it slips by and I forget to do anything about it. But yeah.
And what station is that? Or whereabouts? Are you out in California?
Yeah, I give to both of our public radio stations. I give to KPCC and what's the other one? KCRW, I think. Yeah, that's right. But I mostly listen to KPCC.
Gotcha. Okay, real quick, what was your favorite gig ever? And I don't mean like a particular show, like of all the different, because you've done so many different things, you've worn so many different hats. Do you have one that's a favorite?
I'm very, very lucky to be a stand-up comic. Really lucky. It's the greatest job in the entire world. And having said that, it was many years ago I covered the conventions for the Republican and Democratic convention for the Tonight Show, and then I covered the inauguration as well. And it was really exciting. And I also did backstage coverage for the Emmys at one point. And they've had other people do that since then, but I was the first person they ever had do it. And in fact, it was my manager's idea, and she really wanted me to be in a position where I could do what I do, which is not scripted. And so when I would do rehearsals for either of those jobs, the rehearsal was just this. I would say, can the camera see me if I stand here? That was a whole rehearsal. They go, yeah. I go, great. Okay, thanks.
Yeah, it's not like you had to riff on something and then do it again later, right?
Precisely. which I learned the hard way years ago is a terrible idea. And anytime anybody tried to insist that I do that after I learned it the hard way, I'm like, no, thank you. But so those kinds of jobs, which is what allows me to do too, which is, and allows all of the players on Wait Wait to do. But those were, they felt like high stakes jobs, and so they were really exciting.
Do you have any big projects on the horizon? Do you have maybe another book down the road, or what's going on with you?
Well, I'm hoping to write another book, yes. But right now, I'm working on a podcast with my partner, Adam Felber, called Nobody Listens to Paula Poundstone. And, it feels weird to say that I'm working on a podcast because the fact that I'm alive, makes that so. It's one of the few things that human beings have entirely in common right now is that we breathe oxygen, we don't eat our young, and we have a podcast.
That's really funny because I just launched a podcast.
There you go. Yeah, it is. I'll tell you, Adam and I are really having fun doing it, and I think it's funny, and I think it's good, and I hope it's successful. But let's be honest. A podcast is to show business what a yard sale is to commerce. You do it partly just for the love of doing it.
That's true, but I also think that it's a revival of radio. I mean, if you take the word podcast off it and call it radio show you get through the internet, it kind of frames it a little differently. I think that people are returning to this idea that this simple technology that we've had for so long has a power, that listened to voice, no pictures, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, know, a lot of people, what's interesting is there's a culture of commuters that stockpile their podcasts. And people talk about how Los Angeles has such terrible traffic. Let me tell you something. I go all over the country. Traffic is terrible everywhere. So if you have a long commute, it really is a fun way to, and you can select. You can go, here's one that's informative, here's one that's funny, here's, one that's, that's both. And I think people like the unvarnished nature of the podcast, I guess.
Yeah. Well, that is all the time we have for this part of today's show. I want to thank my guest, comedian Paula Poundstone. She'll be performing one night only at the Barbara B. Mann Performing Arts Hall in Fort Myers on Friday, March 2nd. Her latest book, The Totally Unscientific Study for the Search for Happiness, of the Search for Happiness, is available wherever you get your books. Paula, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it and hope you enjoy your time here in Southwest Florida.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. Thank you so much.
All right. Well, have a great day.
You too.
When we come back from this break, we'll meet a man who grew up in Southwest Florida that is now a successful special effects artist in Hollywood, working on productions like Stranger Things and the new Predator film that's due out this fall. You're listening to Gulf Coast Live on WGCU. We are NPR for Southwest Florida.